I'm reading a couple of extracts from a short biography of Lumpur Liam that appears in the back of this book called No Worries, and then finishing with a talk he gave in 2006. Lumpur Liam summarises what he found most impressing about his new teacher, Lumpur Chow. From all my experience, I would say, Lumpur Chow was different from anybody else. His character was not like anybody else's because of his strong, heartfelt inclinations to sacrifice and giving. In my experience, he was absolutely resolute in his actions. He would say what he was going to do beforehand, and he would act like he had said. Somebody practicing like this is very hard to find. In his practice and all his actions, Lumpur Chow was always wide awake. Lumpur was the kind of character that people always liked. His whole personality was worthy of respect, worthy of bowing to. From all these experiences, I felt Lumpur Chow was somebody who could really give us guidelines in the teaching and in the practice. Now I'm picking out where he's describing the way he practiced and the routine at Wopapong. For alms round, I was scheduled for Bangor, which in those days wasn't such a pleasant route as today. The road wasn't good. It was full of mud and cow and buffalo dung. This was something normal at that time, so I didn't think much about it and just did my duty. Walking through the mud was a good test of the reactions of the mind. I'd establish mindfulness and start walking from the monastery to Bangor. I didn't think much about the past or the future and just stayed with the experience of awareness. While going on alms round, I tried to follow the principle of restraint in accordance with the standards that the Buddha laid down in the Patimokkha. These practices were very good opportunities for training. I didn't have many belongings or requisites, only the bare necessities. Anything extra would be communal property. At most, I had candles and matches for use at night time, so there would be a little light for practicing sitting or walking meditation or for going to the toilet. One would use a candle to light the way. After the meal in the dining hall was finished, I'd go back to my hut and do walking meditation. On some days, I'd allow myself a little rest just after midday, only 30 minutes, not much. I don't really like to sleep during the day. At 1 o'clock, I'd read some Dharma book or check up a little on my chanting. I didn't open up the books too much. I didn't want to get into studying, as I had been involved with this before and I felt fed up with it. The studies I had done didn't seem to have helped me much, so I decided to stop. I had come to practice. In the afternoon, I did walking meditation until it was time to haul water, clean the sala and the toilets, and sweep the paths. I used to clean the lay people's toilets. In those days, there were only two of them, but the people that used them were mostly people that had never used a toilet before. Sometimes they wouldn't flush with water, or they'd leave a used twig in the toilet. Cleaning those toilets was good practice. Often the toilets were blocked and I had to use some wood to clear them. Mostly I didn't mind, but from time to time I felt averse, thinking, why do these people rely on me rinsing and flushing the toilet for them? When there was no water, one had to carry it from the well. Two people were needed to carry the water. There was no cart. Even if there had been a cart, we wouldn't have used it. One was supposed to carry the water. All these practices build a good foundation for monastic life. A monk accomplishes his duties with diligence, the way it is outlined in the monastic routines in the Vinaya, such as the toilet duty. Actually, in those days, the toilets weren't very clean. It was just a matter of preventing them from smelling. After chores, I'd bathe, go back to my dwelling, and do walking meditation again, waiting until it was time to come together for evening meditation. These routines are good for building up habits of applying oneself with diligence to the practice, and they help to prevent one from losing the ground of where one's at. To train like this every day also makes people feel in good spirits. On the one prior days, I would undertake the Dutanga practice of Nisajik, that is, to refrain from lying down for the whole night. I could actually manage to do this easily, just considering it as a trivial thing to do. Day and night become what they are only through us defining them according to certain experiences we associate with them. When one simply resets one's associations, day can become night and night can become day. Could I really do this? Well, we were supposed to, so I tried. Sometimes I was able to go through the night without lying down quite easily, but sometimes I must admit there was a bit of exhaustion, though not to the extent of real dukkha, as I took it as a normal experience. On some days I looked for other occasions to have a rest. Not having slept all night, I sometimes had a rest during the daytime. Actually, to have a rest doesn't necessarily mean that one has to fall asleep. If one enters the peace of seclusion by meditating, one also rests and regains energy. Generally, Lumpo Liem always trained himself to being content with little. Even with his personal tasks and duties, he didn't accept the help of his fellow monks and novices. It became his habit to always look after himself, even though he was already one of the elder monks in the monastery. Elder monks in Wat Pao Pong are usually looked after by the junior monks who do the washing of bowls, clean their kuti and look after their arms, washing of robes, clean their kuti and look after their arms bowl. It was Lumpur's natural disposition to be responsible for his own things, not wanting to be a burden to others, not expecting the support of others or having to rely on them, but instead always quietly offering help and support to the community in a variety of ways. He was an inspiring example of selflessness, in line with the example of his teacher, Lumpur Cha. This style of practice is one of the reasons why he didn't socialize much with the other monks, and therefore had the chance to practice fully up to the limit. I came to Wat Pao Pong with a mind that was interested in the training, practice, and development of myself. I undertook some special practices all for myself. For example, after the group meditation meetings in the evening, I took the opportunity to put forth some more effort in the practice, trying to develop diligence as a habit. I didn't socialize, I didn't relate to other monks, I didn't speak with anybody. In that rainy season, we were almost 50 altogether, if I remember correctly. I didn't get into contact with anybody, living like somebody who really takes his chance. And the opportunities for practice were fantastic. I was trying to train myself in understanding all the feelings that arise when one is completely left to nature. If we are given a chance like this, we need to try hard and be resolute to use it. But it wasn't always the case that I was very diligent. Sometimes I also felt lazy. Laziness comes up when egotistic feelings take hold of us. What I did to face this was to ask myself constantly, what have I come here to do? Sometimes when I felt confused, in a strange mood or wasn't feeling well, I used the technique of staring at a casino object. But the focus of my casino wasn't anything extraordinary. I simply looked intensely at the skeleton, which was displayed in the sala of Wat Pao Pong. I stared at the skeleton in a way that gives insight into the nature of the material components of the body, rupakanda. I took the nimitta of the skeleton for contemplation. The skeleton was my regular meditation object. When one sees a nimitta such as this, it stays with one wherever one goes. If one starts sitting samadhi, one sees a skeleton. Whatever one looks at appears as a skeleton. On other occasions when I came back from having a look at corpses, visions of dead bodies would stick in my mind as nimittas. If one sees nimittas like these, feelings of diligence and motivation in the practice will arise. One won't forget where one is at and what one is doing. There is a feeling of continual wakefulness in all postures. One feels that one has found a place of independence, all by oneself. In sitting meditation, one is able to sit continually, but without falling asleep. There is mindfulness and awareness. One is able to determine how to spend one's time appropriately and won't let it pass by uselessly. The rains retreat is a time when the monks of a monastery usually intensify their efforts and practice. Lumpur's high aspirations and motivation led to a powerful experience at the beginning of the rainy season, of which he tells. I experienced something stranger than anything I had ever experienced before. From the beginning of the rains retreat on up to the second month, I felt great sadha in the practice. There was no decline, no thoughts of discouragement at all in my practice. The practice went well the whole time, although there were a few experiences of the mind getting involved with desires or defilements, but they weren't very strong. Take sexual desire, for example. If I experienced agreeable feelings arising when relating to women, I could retreat to recollect a subha kamata. Taking either my own body or another person's body as an object of investigation. Seeing it as something filthy and unworthy of craving and attachment. For example, I could see it as a skeleton, perhaps one that's walking about. Or I could see the internal organs of a person cut up in pieces and taken apart. This leads to a feeling of disgust, dispassion and revulsion with one's own body and the bodies of other people. Possessing mindfulness in this way seemed sufficient for providing clear guidelines in the practice. From then on, the feeling of having to think about things in various ways became less. The citta sankhara, or the thinking mind that goes into all directions, felt like it had no strength. It abated and retreated more and more until it was a state which one might say wasn't dangerous anymore. Around the middle of the rainy season of the year, 1969, Lompo Cha encouraged the monks to practice with special intensity. They weren't supposed to speak to each other, and the communal morning and evening meetings for chanting and meditation were cancelled. Lompo Cha saw that it was a time to give the monks more opportunity to do practice on their own. So Lompo Liam increased his efforts, and as he did so, results became evident. On the 9th of September, around 10 p.m., he experienced an immense transformation in his mind. He had a feeling of extraordinary brightness and happiness, of which he reports. It is impossible to describe this kind of happiness to someone else. It is impossible to make someone else know and understand it. It isn't the happiness of getting things according to one's wishes, and not the happiness because things are agreeable. It's the kind of happiness that goes beyond these two. Walking is happiness, sitting is happiness, standing is happiness, and lying down is happiness. There's your experience of delight and joy all the time. Furthermore, one is able to uphold the knowledge in one's mind that this happiness arises completely by itself and eventually will vanish by itself. Both sukha and dukkha in an experience like this are still entirely impermanent states. I was able to maintain the knowledge of this fact all the time. In every posture, standing, walking, sitting, and lying down, there was a continuous and equal experience of happiness. The state was the same whether I was doing sitting or walking meditation. If one were to try to describe the mind in this state, one could say there is brightness, but the word bright actually doesn't describe correctly what the experience is like. It is as if there is nothing that can make the mind get involved with anything. This experience lasted for a day and then changed again. Then the mind became utterly peaceful, not at all exhausted, tired, or sleepy, but filled with clarity, radiance, and coolness, imbued with various kinds of delight and rapture. This experience lasted completely without reference to time. It was truly akaliko, timeless. The same feeling continued on through all the four postures. Eventually I asked myself, what is this? And the answer was, a mode of the mind. It is like this in itself. When there is happiness, we simply take it as happiness. It is simply a matter of happiness. When there is peace, we simply take it as a matter of peace. And we just look at our happiness on, and we just look at our peace on, unremittingly. Eventually, on the evening of the 10th of September, a change to something new that Lumpur hadn't experienced before took place. A feeling of weariness, frustration, and fatigue took over. Whenever he sat or walked, he felt sleepy. Even after he got up after having rested, the tiredness remained. In each posture, he felt completely exhausted. It got to the point where he fell asleep while he was doing walking meditation and ran into some thorns. His whole face became scratched and sore. At least the sleepiness will disappear now, he thought. But the fatigue continued to remain as strong as before. Still he endured, telling himself that this is natural to face obstacles in that practice, which is to some extent everybody needs to pass. With these reflections in mind, he understood that he needed to look at this tiredness that previously hadn't been present. After all, this fatigue just arose, so it was impermanent too. Using this insight, he attempted to maintain awareness of the sleepiness. On the 11th, Lumpur experienced another change, namely a great peace and happiness returned to the mind. Simply being by himself was very pleasant. Nothing could intrude and stir up his mind. External objects impinging on the mind just couldn't reach it. When working together with the monks and novices doing chores, although he was together with others, he felt the same as if alone. He wasn't interested in what they were talking or chatting about. He couldn't be bothered to think much about what was happening at all. And when the chores were finished, he simply went back to his hut. The next day, with the ongoing happiness and peace continuing, as if it was a normal and ordinary experience, with unceasing attention, Lumpur continued to look at both his mind and the objects of his mind. When the evening of the 12th approached, he started to question himself, why do we actually practice? What's all this practice for? The answer arose, we don't practice for anything. We practice for the sake of practice. Whatever it will lead to doesn't matter at all. Our duty is to practice, so we practice and try to maintain mindfulness and awareness with it. In each moment, we keep teaching ourselves. Whatever we are doing, we try to have mindfulness and awareness. Whether we are walking to or fro, we keep everything in a state of perfect balance. Finally, I felt I had done enough walking meditation for the day because I became quite tired and my feet already hurt very much. The bones of my feet felt like they were piercing through the skin as I had been walking the whole day and night without rest. It is normal to experience painful feelings in the body if we overuse a single posture, but it is also normal that feelings change again. So I thought it's really enough walking meditation for today. I went to my hut, put on my robe with the right shoulder open and the outer robe folded over the left shoulder, sat down facing east, the same direction as Lumpur Cha's hut, thought of my teacher and started meditating. The meditation was very peaceful and the same reflection as before came up in Lumpur's mind. We don't practice for anything. We practice for the sake of practice. Keeping this teaching in mind, I kept on meditating. Normally I would sit meditation about 10 or 11 p.m. and then stop to have a rest. But on this day I continued sitting for about 8 hours without moving or making the slightest change in posture. With this experience of peace, the mind changed. The feeling of peacefulness shot up and pervaded throughout the whole body, as if something were taking hold over it. It felt cool, a coolness that suffused the whole body. So very cool, an experience of the whole body becoming completely light and at ease. The head felt so cool the whole day and night, as if there were a fan blowing over it. Cool, peaceful, quiet and still. No experience of thoughts at all, and no clue at all where they had disappeared. Everything silent, completely. It felt totally quiet. The only experience left was that of utter peace and stillness. The body felt tranquil, cool, and light. This experience continued on throughout the whole year, not just for a day or two. In fact, it has continued on unchanging for many years, all from that one go. There is the state of coolness, as if in the brain, whether lying or sitting down, coolness in every posture. All worries, concerns, or similar thoughts from the thinking mind are totally gone. Thinking in this or that direction ceased. All quiet. Just like a forest where there isn't the single sound of any bird singing. Truly quiet. No wind blowing at all. Just ongoing tranquility and peace. This talk is called Following the Footsteps of the Enlightened Beings, and it was given to at a conference for the Australian Sangha Association in June 2006.
He wrote it and it was read out.
He wrote it
himself and then somebody read it out.
So if you haven't seen it before, it's got his writing on one side and pictures on the other. Siam or Thailand is highly renowned all over the world for being one of the countries where Buddhism is thriving and flourishing. This is in part due to our ruler, His Majesty the King, giving royal patronage to the national religion. As a result, Buddhism has flourished, especially in the areas of the study of theoretical knowledge and Dharma education. Still, our country has not yet been able to present to the world an acceptable example of somebody who has gained the highest spiritual fruits of Buddhism. Having emphasized the spreading of theoretical knowledge, we have yet to take the next step to spreading the practice of Dharma. If we have succeeded in this, we will be truly following the footsteps of the noble enlightened beings who we have learned and studied about so much. We have yet to send one of those who have received the full fruits of practice to prove to the world that the path of Buddhism is capable of extinguishing the suffering in the hearts of beings. Just in the same way as modern science is able to relieve the physical pain of the body. Day by day, our lives are coming closer to ending. Therefore, we must strive to follow the footsteps of the enlightened beings and incline towards the highest fruits of Buddhist practice. Thus, we will fulfill our duty as monastics, the obligation to abandon all things that are obstacles to the ending of suffering, to cast them off completely. In contrast to this is the lifestyle of settling down in huge, big residences, the life of a householder who needs to take care of all kinds of possessions and has many worries and lots of responsibilities. Being a householder or a monastic is not defined by the type of cloth worn, be it that of a layperson or a monastic. The way we lead our lives defines us and the spiritual qualities we have. This is independent of the external form or our special status as monastics. Anyone who lives without a house, who does not possess anything apart from the clothes he needs for covering his body, only has a single vessel for taking his meals, and is solely intent on a life free from suffering, can rightly be called a homeless one, irrespective of whether he wears lay or monastic clothing. Coming from the heart, the principles of Dharma are not aiming at taking status or anything external as essential. We need to maintain the Dharma in our hearts, develop an internal resource of refined thinking, and have the dedication to act accordingly. This means to follow the footsteps of the enlightened beings in our actions. If we keep following the footsteps of the enlightened beings, we will eventually discover a science of the mind, spiritual knowledge, that can be of great benefit for the world. We will be able to maintain this lifestyle with dignity in its original form, bring it to the West and create something useful for the world. In fact, the world has tremendous thirst for truth and happiness. Are we going to lay down, waiting for our habits to change by themselves, or are we going to try and do what can be done by human strength and effort, the way the Buddha taught us to? If studying Buddhism by the books was all we needed to do, leading the holy life of a Buddhist monastic wouldn't be anything much profound. Nevertheless, to study the books with the motivation to find a way out of suffering seems worthwhile. But if our primary motivation to study is based on ambitions for gain and fame, we begin the holy life in a wrong way and are likely to go astray. So can we see the danger in this? Isn't it obvious which path leads towards the world and which one leads beyond? How can we hope to be able to pick up the fruits of the noble science of spiritual qualities if we only study the books? Our teacher, the Lord Buddha, was born on the bare earth under a sala tree in Lumbini. He was enlightened, sitting on the bare earth, with just a thin cushion of grass beneath, under the Bodhi tree in Buddhagaya. He entered final nibbana lying down on the bare earth under a sala tree, with merely his outer robe underneath. Nothing more than that. His whole life the Buddha spent on the earth and under trees. This tells us how withdrawn the Buddha's life was. He didn't get involved with using extravagant dwellings. That he was able to realize the truth about the world of the mind is due to just this dwelling in seclusion. If we have never given it an honest try to live in places of seclusion, we shouldn't just assume that we lack the opportunity to cultivate the wonderful qualities that the Buddha taught about. We should cut off the fetters in our hearts that bind us to seeking company, entertainment, and a life of pleasure. We should maintain that it is an honor to frequent the kind places of seclusion that the Buddha himself used with great results and recommended to all of us. And we should hold our being ascetics of the Sakyan clan in honor. through our wholehearted determination to act with honesty towards others and towards ourselves and towards other people. Then we will reach the fruits of the noble science of the mind, an unchanging truth. Our hearts will be liberated, free from slavery to anything in this world. We will experience a power mightier than the sciences of the physical world, a power that is capable of bringing the world to lasting peace and coolness. Isn't the constant lack, hunger and thirst of the world aroused by the temptations and stimulations that modern science constantly keep inventing anew and anew? The scientists of the mind, the noble enlightened beings, have already taught human beings for over 2,000 years to be friends with each other, irrespective of status and position in society. People should grant each other freedom and equal rights, as life dependent on the physical body is the same for all human beings, and animals as well. In the old days, people received education in the science of the mind since they were born. They were taught the science of the mind by their fathers and mothers straight from the beginning. The training of the mind led everyone to happiness and comfort, rich and poor people, the ones still likely to live long, and the ones bound to die soon. Whoever reaches the end of the training in the science of the mind will be able to experience happiness, peace, and coolness for the rest of his life. Even people facing death feel the same peace and happiness as the ones that don't yet have to die. The refined happiness one experiences will only end when finally the physical body passes away. Modern science is different. It constantly causes people to suffer in all kinds of ways because it keeps stimulating the wish for more and more without knowing an end. Just like when somebody is actually full after he has eaten, but still something that he likes even more comes and tempts him. Taking it, he experiences suffering burning him up inside. The wealthy and the poor suffer all the same in this matter until they eventually get a taste of the noble science, a taste of the way of the life of enlightened beings. Why is it that people don't take this wonderful medicine that can ward off all those diseases which arise in the mind? The physical diseases are the duty of modern medicine. Let us make this distinction for the sake of easier understanding. The suffering of the mind is really like a disease. Desire, never being satisfied, never knowing enough, is the virus which causes it. And peace and seclusion is the medicine which cures the illness. Those who lead their lives according to the practices of the enlightened beings are the ones who provide others with the medicine, helping them after they have cured themselves. So let us learn the noble science, the science of truth, and help each other for the highest benefit and happiness for the world, ourselves included. To do this, we need to live our lives in a truly fresh and soothing, cooling way, both externally and internally, deeply bright and radiant, representing a symbol of coolness and tranquility for others. We will be an example for those human beings who experience suffering weighing heavily on their hearts, whose eyes are dull and dark due to the internal consumption by the fires of greed, anger, and by the frustration of their wishes. Only externally representing the force of peaceful ascetics, but internally being full of thoughts of lust and craving, we won't be capable of giving the world an example. We will be like the blind leading the blind. We should create as much benefits for others as possible with our exemplary conduct, even though there won't be any reward for it. By the power of our kindness, other people will develop friendship towards one another as well. We should teach the world by sacrificing our own happiness, giving an example of how one can live well, using only the bare necessities. We can collect what we have saved by refraining from luxury and use it for the benefit and happiness of those other people that are still suffering. All through history, in any day and age, a fully enlightened being, an arahant, would never spend his life in laziness or take advantage of other people by hiding away from society in order to search merely for his own happiness. In truth, the arahant merely waits for opportunities to give others the example of a truly happy person. All the time, all his life, the Arahant is a model of patient endurance, resolute strength, and diligent effort, even for people that aspire only to worldly success. Take a look at the process of becoming an Arahant. It starts with making the same resolution the Buddha himself made. Bhikkhus, all of you should bring forth effort by determining in your minds, even if my blood and flesh all dries up and only bones and sinews remain, if I have not attained the fruits that are attainable by strength and exertion of energy by human beings, I won't stop this effort of mine. This resolution shows that people should be taught to be able to bear with and endure things firmly, relentlessly, and continuously. These qualities reflected in the way of training of the Arahants should already be established from childhood. From the beginning, children should be taught straightforwardness, honesty, gratitude, and the knowledge of how to make their minds happy, so the viruses and diseases of the mind are removed straight from the source. A child will eat what one gives it. Once it has grown up, it will be its own master, and one cannot correct it anymore and all the way to its death. If it wasn't taught to be content with little, it will end up being lazy. Those who have attained to Arahantship will always continue to put forth effort for the benefit of others. They continue to be an example and to teach to patiently endure what nature brings, hot or cold weather, for example. They aim at perfecting what is beneficial, supporting only the essential. For old people, they are an example of somebody whose life ends happily and peacefully, without any struggles. For an Arahant, it is normal to be an example of somebody who is able to sustain his smile in the midst of all the flames of a fire spreading out and burning him relentlessly. To let other people see the example of one's actions, to live so they can see, is much better than to teach using merely words. Therefore, let all of us follow the footsteps of the enlightened beings together. True benefit, happiness and peace will then arise for all of us and for society as well as for our country and for the world.
I didn't quite understand that reference that you made to in the old days, people taught their children from childhood to have the mind peaceful, the science of the mind. And was there a time in Thailand's history where that was a routine part of childhood education, that everybody would learn meditation?
Well, I think, you know, not so much maybe formal meditation, but certainly the values of you're introduced to the, and obviously it would be depend on different families or different, even different villages or areas, but they, you know, it's very ordinary for children to be introduced from the time they're very little of the, say the importance of the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, to be led in, you know, short meditations, to learn chanting, and then they're being mirrored values that are being laid as a foundation in their minds, so that. Maybe Lupalien is a good example in the sense that because his own demeanor and his way of looking at other people is, you know, if you just see him, then you think, he's a really exceptional being. But then you see his sister, and then they're like clones, and there was a point when after Ajahn Chah became ill, then Ajahn Liam was the senior monk. His mother was a senior nun at Wat Pho Phong, and his sister was one of the middling seniority. So that you've got three of these family members living in the same monastery. You know? So it's more like an ideal than the norm throughout the culture, but I think it's common enough that those values are inculcated and mirrored. It's like when little Zina comes, and she's been coming for years, and she's maybe seven now. She's very precocious, high energy, but she's able to really come together, bow, sit quite still when it's needed. And so those are really invaluable skills that are laying those foundations of right view and some right tools to live a skillful life.
Mentioning William always doing things on his own and asking for him and letting people help him.
Right.
When he was here with Ajahn Jani, he was coming into the bowl washing area at the same time Lumpur was, from the opposite door. He had a cup in his hand and he immediately went over and started washing it. Like, came over and tried to grab it. He was away from me. And so I got down and I said to Ajahn Pasano. They grabbed a hold of this cup and he was going to let go of me finally let go.
He's quite exceptional. A good example. He's always led by example. That's been one of his real inspiring qualities, is that he leads by example. And I think now that he's a bit older, then he's much more willing to let people look at him. Of course, the reality is he's 7 years old and he's still climbing up and down scaffolding and up on roofs and whatnot. He's pretty active. There's some great there's little video clips that I haven't shown anybody yet, but Mark Sperrin gave to me when we were together, and it's just some, with the phone taking some video of pouring concrete in the torrential rain, and there's Lopatian just working away, just really steady. And everybody's out there because he's there.
Is he continuing to take care of himself?
Last year, early in the year, there was a major scare with his health because he started to be remiss with his medications, and he wasn't taking his heart medications, he was also in general, he's very, he's always been very careful with food. I mean, he's not a picky eater, but he's not a he's very careful with his food. But he was, I'm not sure how many Cokes a day he was drinking, which was not that good for him. So that he had ended up being taken down to Bangkok, and the doctors, the original doctors who did the stint in his heart and whatnot, then got him re-established in medicines and a different routine. He's a bit more careful with this, with what he's eating. So his health is very good again.
Where you said, Adrian leads by example. Does he go to morning meeting puja? I know that tends to be hard.
No, he didn't never go. It's been years since he's been to morning meeting puja.
So that's in line with the Thai sort of way of doing it?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, in the sense of some of the other senior monks pick up on. But the reality is that morning and evening pujas, if you're at Wat Pa Khom, can be pretty spotty.
I know when I was there for Pansa, he made a point of coming for about the first month to morning and evening puja, but then went off and was doing other things because there was a lot of newly ordained monks. I remember one morning puja, opening my eyes during the puja. It's really interesting, just completely silent. You wouldn't have known he got up, but we probably had gotten up and he was walking through everybody, just looking at people. And just going up and down, and everybody was but completely silent. And fascinating.
Did Ajahn Chah go to morning meeting?
By the time I was there, no. He would show up from time to time, just to sort of see what was going on, but he wasn't going to morning meeting preachers.
Do you know early days of Bhantan, was it always practice on your own? Do you know, did they have morning meeting preachers?
I don't think so, it's a different model.
Okay.
The Damyu Forest tradition tends to not have meetings, and Ajahn Chah is a bit different. It's interesting that he got that model of the morning pujas from Ajahn Thongpa, and he felt that it was a really good. A good model, and actually there's these days there's within the Damyu Forest tradition there's more structure, more evening pujas. So you know, Dan he's got a large community. I think when the community is smaller, then of course it's a lot different. And Mubo Ben in particular felt that it was useful, necessary, helpful.
Does he go?
That I don't know. I doubt it. Oftentimes the senior monks are on the, they'll delegate.
You know, there was a time too when a lot of people, like too many people, really were going to skipping evening puja and going to Lumpur Liam's Kuti to help with the massage, and there was just way too many people there. And I remember him saying, you could hear the chanting in the distance of evening puja, and people were saying, oh, it's nice that some people are practicing over there.
I lived with Bhante Gunaratna. I was trying to get up early enough to beat him to the morning meditation. I never did.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be in 2 hours before the morning meditation. He'd still be,
yeah,
already be there.
I made it once before. It was 2:30.
Yeah.